This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Under the Trump administration, the federal law enforcement agency known as ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, has been given a broad mandate to round up undocumented immigrants and with very little accountability. We don't see much into the inner workings of ICE because journalists just aren't given that much access.
Yes. Hey, good morning, policía.
But the new documentary series on Netflix called Immigration Nation is an exception to the rule. Filmmakers were given access to ICE and its personnel for more than 3 years, which is just unprecedented.
Es que somos la policía, señor. Si miras por la puerta, puedes ver.
The New York Times reported that ICE was so unhappy with the documentary that they tried to delay the release until after the election, though ICE has denied this. The New Yorker's Jonathan Blitzer, who covers immigration, sat down with Christina Clajot and Shaul Schwartz, the directors of Immigration Nation.
There are so many places where I could start, but it seems to me that maybe the place for us to begin is at the beginning. As I and every other immigration reporter in the country can attest, getting ICE to allow journalists any measure of access, even the most limited forms of access, is notoriously difficult. Tell me about your initial conversation with ICE when you first made this pitch to them. I mean, how did you represent the project, and what was their initial response? It seems like they were open to this, obviously.
Yeah, they were. It was kind of an extraordinary way in. I had worked with a local public affairs person for ICE in Arizona way back in 2011. Right. And during that coverage, we kind of became friends and we stayed in touch. And during the Obama years, I had actually pitched the ICE spokesman who had climbed in the ranks during that time to do a show about immigration. And it was a kind of when I say pitched, it was really kind of in a bar unofficially. And ultimately it was like a no-go. When Trump got elected, me and Christina fought about this opportunity and said, why don't we go and meet this ICE spokesman for lunch and see if there's a change, given how the administration was right off the bat pretty aggressive and, of course, notoriously during the campaign, aggressive about immigration. We said, look, there's going to be a lot more heat, not knowing how right we would be. Mm. And we would like to show a portrait of your agents and what it looks like under this administration and what kind of struggles come to light. And that basically got us off to a couple of months of legal negotiations to set the multimedia agreement that kind of let us start the project. We realized that we want to tell a larger immigration story and want to tell the story both of the enforcers and the enforced, but we wanted it to start from inside the system because we thought that was so unique, and it really hit us when we were in El Paso. We knew it was unique, but it really hit us when we were in El Paso Detention Center doing children's separation. We were like, the whole country is talking about this. Nobody could get near this place, and here we are just kind of walking around talking to these people.
Yeah. But tell me, because it's now been widely reported, at a certain point, your relationship with ICE got tenser, when it became clear that they were unhappy with what was due to come out. When did that start? Did that only happen at the very end when they saw the footage, or were there changes along the way where you began to sense a kind of restiveness growing on their end?
It really started during the review process. I think all the way up to that point, you know, we had a really good relationship within the local field offices of ICE and the public affairs office. And so I think it was when the review process, when they started seeing how we were portraying the agency, they, you know, it was holding a mirror up to them. And I think they didn't like what they saw.
And they really, according to the contract we made, had a right to factual inaccuracies and to law enforcement sensitivities and to
privacy violations.
But we started receiving calls that were clear that they were unhappy. The calls became threatening of subpoenas, of different kind of things that were way out of line. Even right off the first episodes, there were specific scenes that they had, in our opinion, and ultimately it would prove legally not to hold waters, they would ask very poor legal excuses of why we should take out a whole scene.
And ultimately, you know, because we had the resources and because we had the legal support, we were able to overcome all the challenges that they pushed back on. And I think that's the thing to note is that really what we put out in the world is the exact, almost very closely to what we envisioned it to be and what we created.
Interesting. Throughout the series, you follow not just ICE officers, but also families, immigrant families who've been caught in the enforcement dragnet. One of them is a Guatemalan father named Bernardo Arevalo. He had been separated from his son at the border. He's alone in detention. And just physically, I mean, his eyes are bloodshot. He has this vacant expression on his face. He seems hollowed out. He shudders almost as he speaks. That to me is one of the things that was so absolutely gutting about meeting parents who had been separated from their children. It was as though a part of their own bodies had been, you know, amputated. It's just so bracing visually to see. I wonder when you train the camera on him the first time, if that was something that really kind of caught you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we had the opportunity to be inside the detention center when family separation and the zero tolerance policy was initially being enacted, you know, a month after or so. And I remember us not really knowing the extent of what was happening. And then to enter a room in the holding cell and the officer to ask how many people here had been separated from their family, and 18 out of 20 of them raised their hand.
Yeah.
And just for us, just the sheer, like, what do you mean that they're all separated from their family? And then the opportunity, and you just saw like the unknowing and the hopelessness in them, like, just like you said, the harrowing out and the sunken eyes, and that a part of them had been taken away. And I think the worst thing about it is they didn't have any information. You know, Josue had been the other character that we follow. Mm-hmm. He had been separated for 30 days already, or 27 days, and had no idea where his child was. And right. I think that was the moments that is just heartbreaking, is that you start to see these change in policies and how quickly they were being enacted and how that was happening. But to hear a father just cry out for the fact that he has no idea where his kid is, and he has no way of getting a hold of him, was heartbreaking.
And in Bernardo's case, what you both capture so well, and I think is really a highlight of the series, is also just the cascading trauma of that separation. And even when Bernardo is eventually released and reunited with his son, there's this really interesting moment where we see Bernardo again with his son.
Eric?
He looks like a different person. He seems to have almost re-inhabited himself. He's smiling. We hear him laugh for the first time. But now he's on the phone with his wife, whom you've also been following, I thought, quite brilliantly, as she's with the rest of the family in Guatemala. And they're talking on a video, and you can see Bernardo is smiling and is cheery and is already now floating the idea of his wife and the rest of the family coming to visit. And she, his wife, isn't smiling.
Cansada.
Cansada, monsieur. Cansada, pero hermosa.
Sí, estoy cansada.
And she seems even slightly resentful. And here he's been in detention for 8 months, and obviously through no fault of his own, But that means that he's out of circulation and that she's having to take care of the family. That just struck me as something incredibly powerful that you were able to capture, and that you could only capture by spending extended time with these families.
Yeah, it's true. And I think at the beginning, it was very important for us to amplify and to illuminate the effects that it didn't only have on those that are detained, but as you said, the cascading effect of what happens to the family around them. And I think that toll that it had on the family back home and the son, who actually, I remember the conversation we had with him very initially when he got to Houston to his aunts, and how he actually put the blame on himself in not so many words, that he felt it was his fault that they were separated at the border.
Yeah.
And so yeah. I think overall it just became this, it was really important for us to show that the human toll and the human cost of these policies is much bigger than you see as it's written on paper.
There seemed to have been, and this is something ICE agents and other would talk about in their cars waiting, and this thought that came from the top, if we can make life difficult enough, if we can send these messages, which is, I think, what children's separation was all about, that this is the hell you're going to get, then we're just going to make these people leave. And one, when you actually look at the people it affects, that is just unbearable. And two, what it really did in our perspective is not, I mean, there's not less undocumented people in this country. They are just deeper in the shadows. So I think what it achieved is maybe people don't come to their court hearings, or maybe if they see a crime around the corner or a woman's beat by her husband and they're undocumented, they won't call the police.
Let me ask about your sense of some of the ICE officers you spoke to. One scene that particularly stood out for me was an interview you did with an officer named Christian, who's a supervisor at ICE, who has authority over what's called the non-detained docket. So the 3 million people in the country who are on ICE's radar, who come in to check in with ICE, but who are not presently detained.
There is an inherent kind of, I won't say joy, but satisfaction in moving some of the people that I know, regardless of what public sentiment is, don't belong in this country.
And obviously one of the trends under the Trump administration is that these people who are trying to play by the rules now that they're in the U.S. are, in the eyes of the administration, sort of low-hanging fruit. Easy people to arrest, easy people to deport, because here they are actually coming in and showing themselves to ICE officers. And Christian at one point says to you both, I don't remove anyone. The judge does.
For all intents and purposes, I'm the taxi driver that takes them from point A to point B. Or I'm the person that's going to execute that order.
How common was that sentiment among ICE officers that you spoke to? It seemed to me that was a real through line in how they spoke.
It was very common. You know, there was that, and there was, I'm just doing my job. You know, if you want to change the laws, you know, Congress is the one that changes them. And, you know, at times I always wanted, through the whole production, I wanted there to be somebody to speak to me more about, like, what that really means. But at times you just felt like they were afraid to talk any deeper because they would be seen not supporting the mission that they were mandated to do.
Is your sense that you didn't hear any of them going off of this script because of a fear of being found afoul of the ICE mission? Or is there maybe just not that level of interiority and depth to how they think about their jobs?
Both.
I think both. I really do. I mean, that's a question that, like, I've grappled with a lot. And I do think that it's, you know, it's both that they don't want to seem like they're skewing from the mission, and also that they seem like they're removed from the bigger picture.
It's not comfortable. It's easier to just do my job. And with that said, you know, on the other side, I think if you deal with this day to day, there's a toll. You get a little kind of desensitized. So, you know, we did see a lot of emboldenedness, and I think in DHS, because of the shakeups, because of the administration, and because sort of the bullies kind of have been gratified to the top in the years we spent in ICE, we saw some of that. But we did see people who dare, you know, have self-look or at least we want to recognize that their job is at times very complex.
I could talk to you for hours more, but thank you both so much for taking the time to chat with me, and congratulations again on the series.
Thank you so much for this
wonderful conversation. We really appreciate it.
Shaul Schwartz and Christina Clajeau, the directors of the documentary series Immigration Nation. It's on Netflix. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More in a minute.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us. Since the killing of George Floyd, we've seen not just a protest movement, but something like a historical reckoning. A lot of white Americans seem willing, at least more willing, to address the reality of systemic racism in the present day. We're learning terms like tone policing, white fragility, and anti-racism. Isabel Wilkerson would like to introduce another term to our lexicon, and that's the term caste. Wilkerson argues that what we have in the United States is a rigid social hierarchy akin to the caste system in India. She writes, "We cannot fully understand the current upheavals or most any turning point in American history without accounting for the human pyramid encrypted into us all." Wilkerson's new book is called Caste: The Origins of Our Discontents. It's just out this week, and she's previously the winner of a Pulitzer Prize and many other awards. Now, your first book was a masterpiece on the Great Migration, and it was both history and personal stories of families who made that essential journey. This book is personal too in many ways, but in some ways it's a book about the search for a metaphor, search for a better, more accurate description of what American racism is. Why is racism somehow insufficient as a description of the way we've lived in this country for centuries, really?
Well, it's so interesting that you put it that way, because, and that you mentioned The Warmth of the Suns, because that book, as you know, was about the people who were fleeing Jim Crow repression. And in writing that book, you know, I was having to discover the many ways that the Jim Crow South repressed this entire group of people. And in fact, all people were repressed under it. They just weren't aware of it. You know, it was a world, you know, as you know, in which it was against the law for a black person and a white person to merely play checkers together. It was a world in which African-Americans could not pass a white motorist on the road, no matter how slowly that person was going. every aspect of life was so tightly controlled and scripted and restricted. And emerging from the research into that era, I realized that race was an insufficient term to capture the depth and organized repression that people were living under, that the only word that was sufficient was caste. And I find it at this moment that of upheaval that we're currently in, that we need new language. You know, we need a new framework for understanding the divisions and the and how we got to where we are. It, in some ways, still held captive to the hierarchies that were created, you know, many centuries ago before any of us were here.
Well, why is caste specifically the right language? Why is that descriptor apt to the American experience?
Well, you know, caste is essentially an artificial hierarchy. Graded ranking of human value in a society determines standing and respect and, you know, benefit of the doubt, access to resources through no fault or action of anyone's own. It's just, it's what you're born into. Caste is the infrastructure of our divisions that undergird the more visible delineations that we make among ourselves. In other words, as I often say, I mean, it's, you know, caste is the bones, race is the skin, and then class is the diction and the accent and the education, the clothing, the things that we can control as we present ourselves to the world. Each caste system creates a different metric for division of who should be where in the hierarchy. So in some caste systems, it's religion, and some caste systems, it may be geography or ethnicity. And in this caste system, it's skin color or race as we now know it to be.
There's a story in the book about a little boy who played baseball. His name was Al Bright from Youngstown, Ohio.
Yeah.
What is his story, and explain why it was so important to you to include it in the book?
That is a story that just so gets to me. It's hard even to talk about. It's a story about a little boy, Al Bright, as you said, who was on the Little League team, 1951. The Little League team he was on won the city championship. And so the coaches decided to take the whole team out for a celebration party, went to a local pool, a municipal pool, meaning a public pool, where they were going to go treat the kids to a pool party. Al Bright was the only black member of the team. And upon arrival, the lifeguard instantly pulled Al Bright aside. And the lifeguard said that he would have to stay outside of the pool area. He was behind a fence and could not come into the general pool area. That actually is in some ways, the definition of caste. It's setting boundaries as to who can be where and who can be admitted into spaces of privilege and who has to be forced outside of it. In any case, eventually, the coaches decided that they couldn't take any further. So they went to the lifeguard and said, "What can we do? This is so unfair for him not to be able to go inside." And what they ended up doing was they had all of the people who were in the pool, all of the white people, were forced to get out of the pool. And then and only then could Al Bright be brought into the pool area. He then was told to get on a raft. And then the lifeguard got into the pool. And he then pushed the raft around the pool for one turn. And the entire time that the lifeguard was pushing him in that raft, the lifeguard said to him over and over again, "Do not touch the water. Don't touch the water." That was a gut-wrenching experience. Even as I think about it now, it's so hard to even capture or even imagine the pain and horror of that moment. What happened to him is what I describe as one of the pillars of caste. I compile these eight pillars that are universal to caste systems that I studied. And one of the essential pillars is what's called purity and pollution, protecting the sanctity and purity of the dominating group at all costs. in India, the Dalits, formerly known as untouchables, were not to drink from the same well as the dominant caste people. They could not be in the same waters. One of the biggest race riots that occurred in the United States was in 1919, when an African-American boy, teenager, was swimming in Lake Michigan, and he accidentally swam over the imaginary line between what was considered the white water, the place that white people swam, and the black water, which is where the black people swam.
Thereby polluting it.
Exactly. Even for a second.
You mentioned 8 pillars of caste. What are some of the other pillars that you see as universal in caste systems?
One of the earliest pillars to be introduced during the founding of the country was the definition of who could marry whom. And that in the original caste system of India is a term called endogamy. And endogamy means, essentially, is focused on the dominant group only being able to marry within the dominant group so as to keep it pure. So they're all interconnected as well. Another pillar of caste is the religious underpinnings, finding some type of spiritual justification for the division of people. And in the Western world, people turn to the story of Noah and his 3 sons and about the curse of Ham. And to justify what the colonists were doing is that they said that people of African descent were the descendants of Ham. And these are the beginnings, the framework that we now live with. So that does not mean that all of the pillars that I'm describing, which are the foundation of our society, it doesn't mean that all of them are in full force now. It means that they existed for a very long time. In fact, they existed for longer than they did not exist.
Isabel, what do we gain by using the term caste to name our society somehow, rather than the words racism or discrimination that we're all familiar with?
This is not to say that racism doesn't exist. It's saying that there's something more powerful, something even more powerful underneath it that we are not seeing. The studies of unconscious bias will indicate that people really, they do not see themselves as being racist. So it's very hard to get people to even acknowledge that to begin with. And what's underneath that is the enduring impulse to still keep people in a certain place. The idea that you should always remain at the bottom, in the same way that a caste holds a person's bones in place when there's a fracture. Caste wants to hold people in a fixed place, even without conscious awareness of it.
Now, in Indian society, I don't think there are any Brahmin kids who spend hours daydreaming about this or that iconic Dalit figure, untouchable figure in popular culture. Whereas in the United States, and this has been the case for a long time, there are a hell of a lot of white kids going to see Denzel Washington and Will Smith movies and Beyonce and all the rest. Black culture, as so many critics from Ralph Ellison on have been insistent on telling us, and they're absolutely right, is American culture. And popular culture in so many ways is black culture. And yet we have this huge, powerful strain of racism, North and South. How to reconcile that? How to think about that in terms of your book?
Well, I have to go back to the history of how we all got here. I mean, literally how we, as different groups, arrived to this country. And people who arrived and were ultimately enslaved for 246 years, the one area that, or role that they were permitted to perform was to be as entertainers, to be as people who were there at the behest of the people who were deemed above them to entertain, but more importantly, to be the butt of entertainment, meaning the minstrelsy of the 19th century. That, however, the brilliance, though, of the people who were in the subordinated caste was that they turned that to their own advantage. They found this one narrow pathway that had been created and actually made the most of it by excelling in the area that had been sort of carved out for them.
Now, caste in the Indian sense comes from religion. It's inscribed in Hindu religion, and when something like that is inscribed in religion, it suggests a certain immutability. It can't change. Can caste in the Indian and the American sense that you're describing it change?
The essential framework of a dominant group and a subordinated group and of the middle groups that move between the two, it is essentially the enduring framework for our society, though we may not see it. The things that do change are who may qualify to be in the dominant group and who might move in between the middle caste. But what often remains the same is the existence of the dominant group and the existence of the bottom group.
But does that suggest that a caste system has to be thrown off psychologically or legalistically?
There have been so many efforts in this country, noble and important efforts to address the essential injustices. And so it's my view that it takes more than legislation, although legislation is essential. It also takes a recognition of why the legislation was necessary to begin with.
Isabel, you've been working on this book for years with just a tremendous amount of research and reporting, but now it's being published unexpectedly into the teeth of a political uprising. And I wonder what effect that's had on your thinking about the book.
I take the longer view, essentially, of history. I had no say, obviously, in the timing of this. I had no wish to be in the middle of any particular moment. I view this in a transcendent way of trying to illuminate our divisions so that we can find a way to transcend them, because we keep reliving the same movie as long as we continue to ignore what's gone before us. And so I view this as part of a continuum. But I am, of course, hopeful that if this opens people's hearts and minds more readily to what I've written, then that hopefully would be to the good.
Isabel Wilkerson, her new book, Caste: The Origins of Our Discontents, is out now. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More in a minute.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
So briefly, now that we have a pretty full group, thank you all for joining. Really appreciate it.
On a Thursday evening in June, two teams faced off in a competitive debate, making opposing arguments on a single issue. And given the times, it was all on Zoom.
The debate will be started via a coin flip, and that will determine the size of both the government as well as the opposition.
This event was co-sponsored by the Yale Debate Association, which is more than a century old and one of the most successful college debate societies in North America.
I think I speak for the entirety of the YDA and the board when I say that this is the most excited that we've been for an event all year.
As to why that night's debate was such a big deal, our producer, Kalalia, explained.
A few weeks ago, I set up my laptop at my kitchen table to watch a debate inspired by the protest over the killing of George Floyd.
All right, so I'll call this house to order. I'll call on the Honorable Prime Minister, Lewis Conway, to deliver the first constructive speech of the round, not to exceed 3 minutes. Hear, hear.
To the Speaker of the House, guests, and my esteemed opponents, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to propose.
This is Lewis Conway, Jr. His team won the coin flip. That means they get to choose which side to represent. In debate speak, you either pick government or opposition.
His argument is the current iteration of policing that is used in the South is directly connected to the abolition of slavery and that Southern agricultural economy.
Tonight's topic is defunding the police. The question is, should the policing budget be reduced by more than 25%? And should those funds be reallocated elsewhere to reduce crime, violence, and injustice?
The crime that created policing in the South was the freeing of the slaves in 1865. That crime against the South was a spark to the kindle that continues.
Watching over Zoom, I can see that Lewis stands out. While just about everyone else is wearing t-shirts or more comfortable looking clothing, he's wearing a suit jacket. And what makes this debate different from other college debates is that Lewis is not an undergraduate student at Yale or any other university. He's a former felon who started debating just 10 months ago, and he's part of a nonprofit organization called the Rikers Debate Project.
We beg the Speaker of the House, guests, and judges to consider the fallacy upon which any argument to the contrary can be honestly considered. When I ran for City Council,
the Rikers Debate Project teaches at Rikers Island Jail Complex in New York City, plus in 8 other prisons and jails. It teaches debate skills to both incarcerated people and those who have been released. Some of the formerly incarcerated people are called fellows. Fellows like Lewis are teamed up with debaters from Princeton, Columbia, and for tonight, Yale University.
Comfortable with co-signing dollars flying out of the unemployed pockets into the coffers of colonial racism. Ask yourself that question.
That was thanks to the Prime Minister, and now
we'll talk about Lewis later. Up next is Camilla Broderick.
Opposition speech of the round, not to exceed 4 minutes. Hear, hear.
The opposition is against defunding.
She's also a former felon, and her team is arguing against defunding the police.
Redistribution of funds is necessary to create a better police force. Our first point is that defunding the police will only lead to an increase in cutting corners, and a lack of resources leads to a lack of accountability. Many small and underfunded police departments already can't pay for ongoing training. They can't fire problematic officers or fund investigation into police misconduct. In a suburban town in Chicago.
My time in Rikers was excruciatingly boring. You couldn't have books. You couldn't visit the library. They wouldn't even give me the newspaper. I was sitting there reading like the backs of like condiment bottles and shampoo bottles. There was just absolutely nothing.
When Camilla was introduced to the Rikers Debate Project, she was serving an 8-month jail sentence. She was 26 years old. But her troubles had begun many years ago.
I didn't really look forward to anything. I had depression since I was a very, very young girl.
Camilla is not the typical Rikers debate student. She grew up in a comfortable middle-class household with parents who were college professors. And she went to an all-girls private high school in New York City.
People who come from wealthy families have the means to buy a lot of drugs. And they do.
She said cocaine was rampant at the school. And to cope with her depression, she started taking opiates and then heroin. She was selling the prescription meds she was given to treat her addiction. One day, she sold a small amount of heroin to a buyer she had met on Craigslist.
I thought everything was fine. And then, as soon as I get in my apartment, I walk into the lobby and like 3 cops grab me and drag me outside.
Camilla had been set up by an undercover police officer, arrested, and sent to Rikers. About 3 months into her sentence, a guard walked into the dorm to announce that the volunteers from the Rikers Debate Project were there to teach a class.
My first impression was, first of all, that the volunteers for it were very, very nice. They were asking us how we were and how our week was, how our families were, and things like that that other people who come in didn't do.
The Rikers Debate Project was founded in 2016. Now it's run by one of its former volunteers, Caitlin Halpern.
Most of our students in jails and prisons have never had access to a debate team or a public speaking class. And I think inculcating those skills serves them really well, both to advocate for themselves and their communities, and also just in their relationships and in job interviews. And I think the other service that's really meaningful for me to provide is just providing confidence for people. I've had so many students tell me that no one ever told me I was smart, and I never thought of myself as the kind of person who could do this.
So if I can structure these real quick, Charles and Camilla, do you remember at the end of our last debate when Camilla, I said how awesome your first speech was because it was two pieces of offense and then one piece of terminal defense?
I was able to listen to a practice session coached by a man named John Langle, who's a business analyst. Because of the pandemic, the debate project had to stop in-person classes. Now they mail a correspondence course to their incarcerated students. But the debate fellows, who are no longer in prison, have been practicing on Zoom.
If in our contention three, we can prove that defunding the police makes the police better, that is terminal defense against every possible argument the opposition could make. So I think we do a little research on one, Camilla's community policing piece, to see if there are good empirical examples.
Camden, New Jersey, cut their excessive force by 92% and their violent crime by 42%.
See, that's dope. That's perfect.
That's off the top of my head.
Yeah, that's perfect.
The debaters research their topics and construct arguments with 3 points. And they have 7 minutes in total to argue their points. And remember that coin flip? Whoever wins chooses which side their team will argue. So Lewis and Camilla must be prepared to argue both sides.
You have to understand, these folks that are in the Rikers Debate Project, they're doing this on their own time, as opposed to, I think a lot of collegiate and high school debaters are generally there for one of two things. One, and there's nothing wrong with these two things. One, for it to, you know, look good on their resume, or two, they, like I did, they become extremely competitive and just want to win as many debates as possible just for the sake of winning debates. So I think the motivating factors are very different, and that shows in the debate practices.
But it definitely isn't easy for people in prison or recently released to participate in something like this.
Because of the way inmates and former inmates are treated in America, the regular amounts of stress and difficulty that our debaters are going through from any number of issues is massive. And so getting them to a mental and emotional place where they are able to clear their mind of the other things that are happening, focus on the debate, and do so in a way where they're having fun, that I would say is the most difficult.
The only males in my family that have my last name that haven't been to prison nor have died by violence is my father and my children.
That's Lewis Conway Jr., who you heard earlier during the Yale Zoom debate. He joined the Rikers Debate Project years after his release from prison. Lewis is originally from Texas, and about 20 years ago, he was selling crack cocaine to help pay his college tuition, and he was robbed. He felt like he had to confront the alleged thief. Things got really ugly, and he stabbed the man. To Lewis, it was a case of self-defense. The officer took his statement and left the interrogation room. And then, as Lewis recalls, he returned with some news.
And he was like, "Mr. Conway,
guess what? Congratulations. You've just been charged with intentional murder. Why don't you go ahead and stand up so I can take your picture? And I tell people that that picture is it's a photograph of a 21-year-old kid that just saw his life flushed down the drain.
Lewis was convicted and served 8 years in prison and 12 years on parole. Last year, he was hired by the ACLU in New York City to be a campaign strategist. His new boss connected him to one of the founders of the Rikers Debate Project.
He handed me a packet, and it was an ARE packet. And ARE stands for Assertion, Research, and Evidence. And I pretended like I knew what it was because I didn't want to appear ignorant. But I had no clue. I had never seen any of the language before. There was these graphs talking about prime minister and governor. In prison, we had debates, but this was something different.
After that meeting, Lewis went home and spent hours watching YouTube videos of debate teams.
It's important we do not confuse perfection with justice. Justice is concerned.
And something that I noticed wasn't happening on the debates I saw on YouTube was that it was very academic. It was very. Everybody was trying to sound smart, if you will. And I felt like, you know what? Let me get in here and make somebody feel a certain way. Folks deserve to have access to healthy homes. And the opposition spoke about the impact on the family. What good is a family member who has come home from prison and still engaging in drugs and still engaging in violence? What good is that person in the home?
That was Lewis at his very first debate at Columbia University as a Rikers Fellow.
At Columbia, I think we were debating whether or not to end the use of private prisons. And I had to debate the opposition side, which is kind of an oxymoron because really that means I'm for private prisons. And that was confusing at first, too. It took a bit of rewiring how you think. What excited me most was I thought we were going to be debating against each school as a team. And I was really looking forward to kicking some college kids. I was looking forward to, you know, showing up in a way that changed the normal perception of what only incarcerated folks are.
Lewis has done everything from acting in music videos to working as a DJ in a strip club. That's all before being hired by the ACLU.
I work at a very large institution, and oftentimes, you know, you have to argue your point as to why, you know, this certain campaign is important and this budget is important. And so the debate project has helped me navigate that.
All right, it's been 2 minutes, so why don't we go forth and begin with the voting?
Back to the Yale Rikers debate. After a little over an hour, the judges are ready to vote. One of those judges is James Forman Jr. He's a professor of law at Yale and a former public defender. In 2018, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his book, Locking Up Our Own.
Mr. James Forman, would you please provide your vote?
I kept going back and forth. I was don't have experience with this. I wanted it to be a tie, but they told me that it can't be a tie. So at the end of the day, I am voting for the government.
It was Professor Forman's first time judging a Rikers debate, but he's taught formerly incarcerated students in his classes at Yale, so he knows what they're up against. I talked with him after the debate.
You have debaters from an elite institution, and I can tell you that the students from Yale, the first time they go in to participate in one of these debates, they are going to have a bias about the intellectual capacity of the men and women who are incarcerated against whom they're debating. They just do. And every student that I teach tells me at the end of the semester, wow, Professor Forman, I never expected the smartest students in this class to be the students who were locked up.
See, that's the thing that frustrates me the most when reporting stories like this one. Why is the U.S. locking up millions of potentially bright and hardworking people for years upon years? I'm well aware that racism and classism are the driving forces behind mass incarceration. And the number of people who work in the criminal justice system is astounding. But just how many of them are there to truly help? I often wonder what this country would be like if more people, law enforcement, DAs, prosecutors, and civilians, were like the volunteers of the Rikers Debate Project. People who expect the best from their students and not the worst.
Racism and stigma is powerful, and it doesn't only affect white people, and it doesn't only affect the people who aren't incarcerated. People who are locked up have internalized a lot of negative stereotypes about themselves. They don't believe, they might not say it, but deep down, they're not sure they can compete. They have been told their entire lives that they're lesser than. And certainly since they've been in prison, they've been told that they're nothing. And now they're being asked to debate some of the smartest young people in the country? That is scary. But then when they do it, and not just do it, but succeed and thrive and win, that has an impact on your consciousness. It makes you feel like you can do anything.
We reached a verdict. We had a 6-4.
The judges voted 6-4 in favor of the government. That means Lewis's team won this debate in support of defunding the police.
Congratulations to the government side.
And this week, the Rikers debaters are teaming up with scientists to debate the ethics of vaccine trials.
Increasing the efficacy of contact tracing and driving down a curve should be our focus, not funding more ways for us to brutalize people who've already been under the knee of poverty and disenfranchisement.
Lewis Conway Jr., a fellow of the Rikers Debate Project. Kalalia is a producer for our program. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour for this week. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.